I needn't tell you it's a delight to be introduced by Fred Cody, who perhaps has done as much for good books as any bookseller in the country. You know his name is known throughout the country. And I'm thinking, right now I've got this pulpit. Oh, I always wanted a pulpit. I used to work for Mahalia Jackson. Mahalia said, Studs, you should have been a preacher. And here I am with the pulpit, and here are you, my captive congregation. And when I'm through, we're going to pass the collection plate. And I was thinking, let's make this call and response as though it were a black church or a white church in the deep south. Call and response is congregation responding to the preacher. So I would rather than talk, may say word or two, questions and answers. I like the idea of give and take. That's what jazz is about, and I was a jazz disc jockey for many years, and I suppose some would say, what's my manner of working? I have no one way to describe it. I say in the manner of a jazz work. There's a beginning, a middle, and end, and there's a good deal of room for improvisation as I'm working on the book. And so many of the interviews have come suddenly in a certain spot to me in thinking about it, as I said, a good jazz work would be. So what do you like? I would like, at this moment, even, because I could talk, as you know, at length, interminably. I could. But I would rather you start right off. You're coming right in with anything. If I don't know the answer, I'll fake it.
How do you find people to interview?
How do I find the people to interview?
Decentralized.
No one way. Let's say what kind of people I want to interview, and we'll start with that. All right. Now and then there's a celebrated name in the book, but that celebrated name was there for a certain purpose, not because the person is celebrated. As you probably know, most the heroes and heroines of all the books are the non-celebrated. But there are certain kinds of people in every community. I don't mean a university community. In every neighborhood, there's a certain kind of person, not the top preacher of the town or the top principal or doctor, and I don't want to be anti-intellectual now, or anti-quote-unquote elitist. That's not the point. But in that community, a certain person, like all the others of the same stratum, who has a certain way of talk and a certain insight, who is able to articulate the feelings of all the others who may feel it but are inchoate in the feeling of it and can't express it, and that person does it. And so it's that kind of person. Peggy Terry, an Appalachian woman in Chicago whom I know for years. Peggy came from Paducah and traveled around the country. She finished fifth grade, and yet Peggy's poetic and eloquent and became a spokesman for the community. Mary Lou Wolfe, mother of nine kids, middle American, whatever that phrase may mean, but a blue-collar community, generally considered conservative, a word I hate. And while on the subject, I hate the word liberal too, while on the subject labels, I call, what are you, Studs? I say, I'm a radical conservative. I'm a radical. I want to get to the root of things. I hope I can get to conservative. I want to conserve the Bill of Rights. I want to conserve air unpolluted by the predators and the streams. And I want to conserve whatever sanity we've got left, you know. Some radical conservative, just to make the labels meaningless. As to how I find the people, again, it may be a phrase I come across in a newspaper or somebody I know about or a friend of a friend. And there's no one way. I was explaining to Diana Ketchum, the Oakland Tribune here, how I work. Sometimes I was going to see Tom McCall, the governor of Oregon, who's an interesting guy, and his mother, quite a remarkable woman. And while there, his nephew says to me, there's a logger way out there, a couple hundred miles away. And two of his friends drove me out there. And while there, they said, do you know that Japanese couple, that Nisei couple in the internment camp? Well, I want that couple because I want that couple a certain part in my book. So I think out loud sometimes of form. The form, I guess, why I love Louis Sullivan from Chicago, father of the skyscraper. He says, what do you say? Form follows function. In my case, form of the book follows the substance of the book, I think. So there's no one way of planning it. So I want to get a Nisei couple who had suffered internment here, the most shameful of our periods, following Jesse Delacruz. It came to me while going to see this logger, while this couple driving to see this logger in Oregon. Because Jesse Delacruz, a Fresno, a Chicano woman, quite remarkable, who's part of Land for People, bucking the big boys to enforce the California Water Act of 1902. You're not allowed free water if you have more than 160 acres. And so he got these big shots all on welfare, you know, here, getting free water. And so Jesse is telling about a certain moment. And by the way, she becomes articulate without meaning to. Marvelous. So Jesse tells of a certain moment when they were picketing and Japanese farmers are driving through with scabs to break the picket line, but in front of a barbed wire complex, and they start calling Jesse names. The Japanese farmers start calling Jesse un-American, commie, whatever, go back to Mexico. And she says, what's happened to your memory? Don't you see this barbed wire? It's behind that fence where your grandmother was put and your grandfather were taken right out of the little store and business. And I was a little Mexican girl, Mexican-American. I was crying for them. Weren't you? Don't you remember? And the guys hung their heads. So I thought Jesse's story would be marvelous to precede June and Aki Carosa, whom I met in Seattle. So that's how I work, sort of. We'll continue on that some more in some other way, but it's another question. There's more to it. How people talk, what I find the poetry in what is called the common everyday language, people. But we'll come to that. Perhaps even read a piece of the book. It's full of it, I think. Man, this is a standing room only. Wow. A hit show, they say. Buffle. Okay.
Did you have the idea to start as a conservationist of the American people?
No. Did I have the idea to start as a conservationist of American people's language, you mean?
Yes.
No. Never dreamed of it. I'm a disc jockey. I still call myself a disc jockey. Like, I have an hour. Perhaps this could explain about me and my work and working. I like my work. I'm one of the fortunate few because I do an hour program each day on this station. It's primarily a classical music station. I'm its one aberration. And on this 1 hour, it's my hour. I have the power, the decision to do what I might want to read a Ring Lardner story or Grace Paley that day, or Flannery O'Connor, or play jazz or folk music, or read someone died, Bernofsky. So I remember an interview I had with Bernofsky in London 20 years ago. Or do a documentary sometimes. So interview Ronald Steele, did a great book on Walter Lippmann, The American Century, a remarkable book. And I work on the book and work and read it. And so each day it's my decision. And of course, one of the grievances of people in working was no sense of control over their lives or what they do. But as to my having this idea being constant, never, I don't think of myself as that now either. It's just, I just do it, you know. It came about. I must talk of my publisher and editor, because without him, his name was Andre Schifrin of Pantheon, which is a subsidiary of Random House, but he's independent. Once upon a time, we were owned by David Sarnoff of RCA, and now we're owned by Newhouse Papers. That's a conglomerate's work in publishing, you know. But however, he is autonomous. Now, Andre Schifrin was an old publishing family, Kurt and Helen Wolf, names you've heard of, Pantheon. They introduced Thomas Mann to America and brought Kafka writings here. And they escaped the Nazis and then Vichy France, and Andre came here. Okay. Andre Schifrin published, before I started doing a book for him, before he called me, he published the American edition of Jan Myrdal's Report from a Chinese Village, which deals with a small village in North China, people talking to Myrdal, Gunnar Myrdal's son, talking to him about their lives before and after the revolution. And Andre called me up one day. He'd read a few of my interviews somewhere. And he says, how about you doing a report for an American village, Chicago? So I say to him, are you out of your mind? I said, how can you compare a small town in China where something happened on which you can put your hand? There's a before and after. And he's talking to me 1962, 63, 64, where there's a human rights revolution happening, a cybernetics revolution, a technological, and a huge city. So I do Division Street, America. Okay. And that became beginning of a series for him called the Village Series. In England, Ronald Blythe did a magnificent book, Aikenfield. And in East Germany and West Germany and Sweden, there are similar books, guys like me in those countries. Okay. After Division Street is out and is, you know, doing well and recognized, Andre, in his very soft, seductive voice, he has a British accent. When he's, how about a book about the Depression? And I said, are you out of your mind? You know, who would think about the Depression? He said, well, you know, young people don't. So I do Hard Times. Okay, about 3 months after Hard Times comes out, Andre whispers to me again, it's Mephistopheles talking to Faust, you know. And he's saying, how about a book about working? I said, are you out of your mind? And so working. So he really has been, he and I have been very close in the working of this. And then he said, how about a book on power? And I must tell you about this. I thought it's a good theme, and I realized I couldn't do it. Oriana Fallaci could do it because she's so good as an adversary, and she can reveal Henry Kissinger for what he is, this remarkable clown, you know. But she, you read her piece on, well, only she could do it, for obvious reasons, too. You know, I couldn't. But power, you see, when you talk to people who have power, they deny they have power. They lie. You see, if you deny you have power, then you are shrieved of sin. If anything terrible happens because you misused it or didn't use it. And a classic case was Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York. When Tom Wicker did A Time to Die, Tom did the book about the Attica Massacre. Remember, Tom was on the committee. In the book, he speaks of, I don't want to put him on the spot, but it's my feeling, I'm sure he would say it too, that had Rockefeller gone there when the leaders of the riots, mostly black, asked to see the man, he was governor then, there would have been no massacre. Of course not. The governor came to see him. There had been some grievances, perhaps assuaged, some rights, some wrongs righted. But they'd have seen this guy would have come to them. They'd had some feeling of being somebody, of counting. But he said, no, I can't go. It's not within my power. Well, we know he's full of crap. Of course it was within his power. But as a result of which, there was an Attica that need not have been. So these guys who have power deny it, for one thing. The other thing is they're pretty dull people, to me. See, when you have power, you're sitting on something. You're not moving. You're sitting. Whereas if you don't, there's a stirring. And that's the dynamic that excites me. You see. Well, anyway, so I discover that this book deals with power and powerlessness, you know. I'm getting sick and tired of that phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I don't believe that too much. I think powerlessness corrupts and absolute powerlessness corrupts absolutely. So we have kids on street corners in the ghetto who saw or kill each other. And it's the powerlessness that makes them behave so bestially, or beastially. And power gives you a sense of some being over your lives, of course. I don't mean power over lives of others. That could be corruptible, of course. Where was I?
What do you do when you find somebody that you know will make a good interview? The gold that you talk about as being a gold miner as an interviewer. And they almost deny that their lives are not that worthwhile. It's a
this, in case you didn't hear that, that's an interesting question. What do you do with someone who thinks that person's life is really something, but he says, no, it isn't really something. Here's a story. There's an old black man, this is in Division Street. His name, interestingly enough, was Faulkner. That's his name. And I changed it to Fulton because some people wanted their names changed. And this is invariable. Whenever I bump into the person whose name I changed, that person says, you should have used my real name. Because they feel good about it. Well, this guy is remarkable as a storyteller. And it's remarkable. And he's near the end. He says, there were three great surprises in my life. I said, what are they? The first is I. He called himself, he used the word darky, then this old man. I, this black man, was chosen by Swift and Company as the boner. He worked for Swift. He's retired. He's 89 years old, and he's got heart trouble and everything. He's that woman, his wife, she says, I can't work anymore. Oh, that woman. And, of course, the wife goes, and I wish I'd get on tape. She goes, oh, God have mercy. You know, so marvelous. Here he goes again. He was so full of vitality. And so he says, I was chosen as the boner. A boner is very skilled work. You separate the meat from the... A machine does it today. As he said, I'm better than the machine. Well, the truth is he was. Indeed, the skilled manual flesh and blood boner is far better than the machine that bones. He's chosen as the guy at the World's Fair in Chicago in 1934. That's his first big surprise. Second surprise, he says, oh, about 40 years ago, it's Good Friday, I'm in Tampa, Florida, I'm looking in the window, and there's an Easter suit, and a couple comes by, a big guy, a white guy, and his wife says, I want the sidewalk, it's mine, to me. So I suck him and give him the sidewalk. And I run off, and people are hollering at the depot. Did you hear about that crazy nigger had a white man? I said, who did that? Who's crazy enough to do that? And he's on the, and I'm laughing, of course, and I'm pulling the plug out of the wall. He says, wait, where are you going? What's your hurry? You haven't asked the biggest surprise of my life. What's that? Is you coming to see me? What have I got to say that's important? That's the way. People who are important don't feel what they have to say is important. Thus, people in power deny they have power. It's interesting how it works. Well, very often you find, I was telling this to Diana here, the Trib, that I don't want to be anti-academic either, anti-intellectual, but invariably you find the language used by somebody like that, who's had little education, becomes remarkably poetic because it's full of details. I'm going to recount this. For example, in contrast to, say, a stuffy academician. Now, I said a stuffy academician, not the good ones around here. Okay. So, there's a man named Legg from the Deep South, and he's an assembly line guy for Ford, South Chicago, in a trailer. And I said, what's your day like? This is for working. He said, well, I wake up in the morning, first I open one eye, and then I say, shh. And then I open the other eye, and I got to hear that radio go off, and I kiss my wife. That's routine, you see. And then I go to the washroom, and I comb my one hair. And then I have a cup of coffee. But you know something, sir? It might be two cups of coffee. It all depends upon my mood, see. Then I might have a piece of toast, but then again, it might be a toast and a half. And then I get in the car, kiss my wife again. That's quite routine. That's routine. And then I got to get to that plant on time. He's got to get to the church on time, see. Get the plant on time, because I come there 1 minute late, I'm docked an hour. But now he describes the streets. These are railroad crossings where the freight trains go. So if he goes down the wrong street, it's a 15-minute wait, 100 freight cars. And so he describes the scene. It's suspenseful, and it's hilarious. It's incredible, and he makes it on time. Now I talked to a guy, or say a friend of Milton Friedman, you know. I talked to a guy, and he says, I wake up in the morning, I got the class in economics. I teach Milton Friedman, Freedom to Choose, or whatever you want to do. And so that's it. Everything's blank. And this is the abstraction. See, remember, Sartre spoke about during the Vietnam War, about abstractions being obscene, if the abstractions alone. Who drew the scenarios for the Vietnam War? It was Huntington of Harvard, wasn't it, and Rostow. Because abstract, there were no flesh and blood human beings. There were numbers, there were strategic hamlets. And it's all done abstractly, which, of course, is barbarism, I suppose, in its worst form. And so it's getting how people talk. And then again, just to answer this, Bertrand Russell is an academic. He talks another way. So I want to just avoid the generalization. Oh, let's get another. We'll come back. Oh, you didn't, okay.
Could you say a little bit about how you edit the interview?
How I edit?
Yeah, I'm also, interview, and I agonize over editing it. And stuff looks like it comes off so simple, but...
Well, that is the worst part. Yeah. That is the most painful part, the editing. Because here again, how do you cut? You talk to a person a couple of hours, and the woman, Kathy Zmuda, who's remarkable, all the transcribing and all the books, I say to her, keep in every single detail, every slip of the tongue, every phrase misused or used, every laugh, every pause, everything I want in. Because as I read that, I recall that moment of talking that has a meaning, you know. A laugh comes at a strange moment. Say a black person's talking, it's a laugh. And the laugh comes at a moment of humiliation, because the laugh is kind of a safety valve. Like when Big Bill said, I wanted to get a drink with my friends, and they said, we don't serve you. Or a guy gets fired, and the younger white kid whom he trained is there, and he laughs. That laugh, remember the blues, laughing to keep from crying, or to keep from raging, or laughing on the outside, crying on the inside. Okay, so I get all this. Now I cut 70, 80 pages. Now, that's got some great stuff, and it also has a lot of ore in it, and not the dust, the gold dust. So now you got to cut and weave, and also maybe change sequences. All the words of that person. You say, how come you're changing sequences? Well, the interview itself was arbitrary to begin with. The interview is not the Constitution or Testament. The interview starts arbitrarily. It's as you go along. Again, it's jazz. You find something, and so I shift and change. There's 7 pages, and that's the dust. And that's the gold dust. And it's not simply truth. It's heightened truth, I suppose you'd call it, if you're writing a play. Heightened truth. And it's a tough job. And, okay, this book, the painful stuff, of course, was leaving out 200 people. And those 200, every one was just as bit as good. Every one as the persons in it. Then came the terrible choice. My own form of triage, you know. Oh, any, go ahead.
Do you have any favorite outtakes that you had to put
out? No, they all are. I haven't even thought about that. A lot of outtakes in all the books. I suppose people say, why don't you make them books? That's not it. No, it would. No, it's got to be a theme and form and a time, I think. There are a lot. too many... I look at some of those not in, I say, oh, Jesus Christ. Some of those are tremendous. Really. I mean, Will D. Campbell, the preacher from Tennessee, he's out. Miles Horton of the Highlander Folk School. Jane Kennedy, who should have won a Nobel Prize, a peace person. Any number, but you see, they had to go. I even had a trio of people. I had Abby Hoffman, while on the run, had another name, Dave Dellinger, and Rennie Davis. These three, because these three were, to me, the most exciting and interesting of the conspiracy. Forgive me, Tom Hayden fans. Okay.
Could I quote something from the introduction and ask you if you want to talk a little bit about it? You say, yet something's happening as yet unrecorded on the social seismograph. There are signs unmistakable of an astonishing increase in the airing of grievances of private wrongs and public rights, and so on. You go on talking about different kinds of whistleblowing and so on. Mm. It's happening in unexpected quarters and so on. You want to talk a little bit
about that? Yeah, well, yeah, someone say, am I not being too hopeful? I'm neither despairing nor hopeful. Let's say it guardedly optimistic. You know, Bob Sherrill in the Times called it a stirringly hopeful book, and I was delighted to see that. I do want it to be that rather than non-stirringly despairing book, because it isn't. It's neither. But, no, it's neither. But I do think this matter is something stirring. We know what 6 o'clock news covers and doesn't cover. We know things are in, I don't know about here, in certain communities, something is happening on local issues, and that is a danger to a parochialism. But in Chicago, for one, I know full well something happened when an expressway that was sponsored by Daley, who was at the peak of his powers, the brokers of the town, the cement lobby, was all set. And a community, which Mary Lou Wolfe lives, stopped it. They had a meeting, and someone raised what Brunofsky calls the impertinent question. Who needs it? Because the talk till then was, whose street's going to go first? And someone said, who needs it to begin with? And so they stopped it. Fair Share in Boston is working. It has its losses and defeats about more equitable taxation. We've got anti-nuclear movements that win and lose, in which more people join housewives who suddenly discover they understand what it's about. Nuclear reactors is a matter of boiling water. It's boiling water. We don't have to boil millions of human lives to boil water, see. And so they discover things. A woman in Boston says, I used to read what was called the woman's page, and now I read the financial page. I know how those bastards are taking us, you see. So there are these discoveries, and it is happening. But they're not coalesced, of course. They're different. Sure, the local issues. But even though that issue is lost, there's a person in that community, the ones I look for, who has grown. The window was opened, and that person suddenly realizes, not simply same ones who wanted to build the expressway or the same ones who were...
You place a lot of emphasis on people knowing the issues in their own home community.
Well, there has to be. I think we have to know more, because right where you live, I think it's terribly important for small victories, too. Joe Begley in the ghost town in eastern Kentucky is fighting the strip miners. He's losing, and yet there's some victories. And Joe is an eloquent spokesman in that community. His wife, who's a descendant of a guy who fought in George Washington's army who froze at Valley Forge, had a piece of land that was stolen because her ancestors couldn't read or write, an ex. And she's a trespasser on this land. They're great, great, great. She says, I left out a great somewhere, she said. But there he was. And so they're very eloquent people. And so it's popping. And you do have executives blowing the whistle who tell Ralph Nader and others things. So there is stuff popping. You see, we hear a lot about apathy. I'm sure there's a good deal of that, but there's been a spin-off in the 60s that is undeniable. We do know that people are out of closets. We need to name all the movements, you know. And as a result of which there is tension that might not have been before because they weren't even there. They were invisible. And so in event there are things popping, I feel it. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be great. It could go either way, couldn't it? But there is a sense of growing awareness. And I hate polls. You know, polls. If there were no polls, you wouldn't have these clowns running for office. Of course, I leave out Barry Commoner. No, I mean without, except Barry Commoner, of course. But I'm talking about these guys, Jim Aberesk in book, former senator. Jim speaks of these political guys. Even the old conservatives were better than they are, the new ones. They're not even thinking of issues. They're thinking, how am I going to get it? How am I going to make it? Am I ahead in the polls? If there were no polls, we wouldn't know who's ahead. People might be discussing issues, might be having town meetings. If there were no ratings, A show with 20 million people wouldn't be knocked off the air because it's 2 million less than the other one, which, of course, is nutty. And so something's cooking underneath is what I'm saying. It could be good, and it could not work out either. Yeah.
I wonder about the future. Maybe you could make some comment on this in terms of less contact between, say, mother and children, between children or young people and adults. I mean that because mothers work now, they really have what I call a scheduled contact with their children. Same with old people in complex homes. It's a scheduled contact. So I one could say, well, maybe we have a depression and it'll bring people back together. But there's no homestead anymore.
Yeah, well, of course, you said scheduled. The key word there is scheduled. You know, contact. Again, we talk of departmentalization. This much time allotted. As though you could allot time specifically for different people. It's a matter of age, by the way. Of course, you know who Maggie Coon is, of course, you know. And well, Maggie tells stories that are fantastic, and ones I know. I remember, this deals with age. An English sociologist talking about a certain town in London, New Towns, they're called, and his young girls volunteer to go out and help this old woman clean up the place, and they come back rewarded, of course, because she helped them with her wisdom. They had troubles, and they came back richly rewarded. But on that subject, of course, we can talk forever, the matter of generations and personal family stuff. Individual, I think individual cases would have to come into being, but I saw, yeah.
I was curious if before you go on an interview, how much preparation you do?
Preparation.
Yeah, and when you get to the interview, if you have any particular techniques or secrets that draw people out so that they reveal to you as much as
no,
they
the
do.
Last thing I do. See, when I interview an author for a book, I read the book fully, completely. I say nothing magical about it. I am the carpenter who carries his tool chest with him, you know. And I'll come back to the subject preparation interview. So I've been on this tour now, you know. I don't know why. I like being here, but well, why am I on the tour for these books? Why am I on the AM Chicago, AM St. Louis, AM? These shows are all the same, you see. They don't read your book, but they pretend. It's a charade you play. You got the same good-looking young couple. They're very sweet, and they're very nice, and they greet you. And you're there with a jujitsu artist, a woman makes a flower arrangement, with someone who's someone's working for the Inquirer, a story about a scandal. You know, six of them, and you talk for about 5 minutes, you get more coffee, and it's the handsome young black guy that looks like Harry Belafonte, he's there, the token black, and or a pretty girl who's Latino, and now an Asiatic girl or guy. But they're all the same, you see? You go from one town to the other, you wake up in a motel room in Cleveland, and you left a message for the switchboard operator, say, gee, I gotta get up, wake me at 7, I gotta catch an 8:30 plane to get to Detroit. She says, you are in Detroit, sir. And I say, how could I be in Detroit? I'm not doing Detroit till Wednesday. She says, today's Wednesday. I says, what happened on Tuesday? She says, I don't know. And so, it's true. It becomes surreal. Now and then you come across someone read the book. Oh, it's fantastic, you know. But coming back, so I read the book, you know, and says, gee, you're a great interviewer, says the writer to me. I says, I'm the carpenter who carried his tool chest, that's all. He says he's a great carpenter because the guy came with a saw on his plane, you know. And so coming back to this thing, no, I don't prepare for it, certainly not. Don't have, let the person talk. I know about the person. My preparation is knowing something about the person. I know that Claiborne P. Ellis of Durham was once the head of the Ku Klux Klan of that town, and something happened to him I heard about, and how something, his life was altered, was almost a book of revel. I knew that, but let him tell the story of why a poor white joins a Klan, and then how finally he sees a certain kind of truth after that. No, nothing written, no. It's got to be face-to-face. You know. Anybody, shoot, fire away. I'm sorry.
But it's about jazz and politics. Jazz used to have no audience for people worried about being dead in the late 60s. And, you know, there was a lot of concern at that time that it had some kind of special relation to politics. And now you go listen to jazz and there are large audiences again. And politics, you don't hear much about it in relationship to jazz anymore. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I don't. There are a lot of people who are different politically altogether who are jazz fans, you know. You find old potbelly guys, Dixieland fans who are to the right of Reagan, you know. So it doesn't make a difference. Now, I don't think jazz and politics. Jazz, I suppose, among jazz artists, certain ones, you can go on at length. The new freeform guys or the cool guys may have a certain feeling. Many of the best artists are black in that respect, and so there may be strong feelings, of course. But generally speaking, I hate to go into jazz and politics. I'm not sure there's that big a connection, quite frankly. I mean, there may be, but I think it'd be too complex. She had her hand raised, and then we'll, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. My question was basically around your book, Working, and when you interview people about their work, did you find a connection or a... When I read the book, I felt that having a sense of control over your work was the thing that made people's work satisfying. As you have interviewed more people, have you found a way that people can take that control?
Well, there's talk, you know, we hear the word industrial democracy more and more. In some cases where the companies failed, people have taken over. Now, a classic case of deceit and hypocrisy was Carter not recognizing what's happening in Youngstown, Ohio. U.S. Steel. We know that a lot of conglomerates own place, and they close the joint. It knocks a town where that company, that industry kept the company going. They close it. Either mismanaged deliberately, or they make a buck. They got the bookkeepers who can make maybe a better buck if the joint's closed. People from well, in Youngstown, Ohio, the people who worked in the plant wanted to buy the plant. In fact, they already hired some very excellent managers. I mean, executives who were going to work for who were very good, and they were refused a loan by the government. But the government does give a loan to the mismanaged Chrysler. So there is a double standard here, isn't there? So that is something interesting, of course. We know that. And that's happening here and there. But the battles, of course, are over obstacles. Anybody, shoot.
Listening to you talk, you've created an impression of people with no power or everyday power who are vivid and alive, and people who have power as being kind of faceless and shrinking away from their power. I wonder if you think that is really true, and if it's really true, is there anything we can do about it?
Well, I don't mean to draw a generalization that all people of power are colorless. Some are very colorful indeed. Now, the old guy who retired as was retired, head of the biggest food conglomerate in the world, Beatrice Foods, is a very colorful guy. So I'm not saying that. What you can do about it, well, what do you guys think? You organize. What did old Joe Hill say? My God. You know, in communities and on a variety of issues. And, you know, it's a remarkable thing. I quote Nick von Hoffman, who way is paraphrasing Saul Alinsky at the beginning of book two. It's a good quote. May I just, and that's in a way answering this. May I just see that for a minute? And by the way, Einstein, who I like, Einstein, says something in the beginning that's interesting. No, let's go back to Nick von Hoffman here. It's Dreams Public. And here's the quote. One of the things that makes America such an unusual place, isn't it, is that it's perhaps the only society in history in which vast numbers of its members are living their private dream, you know, making it. Now we know they're not making it. With more and more things collapsing, inflation and unemployment, the middle class isn't making it either. But nonetheless, for a time, the personal dream, the private dream, it is a world that is our world here, that teaches the primacy of the personal. I'm going to make it, by God. I'll be number one. I don't give a damn. I'll make it for me and my family. Of oneself, which ironically leaves people powerless. This country has always been saved by a new minority who realize they've been robbed. In the process of righting their private wrongs, they have reanimated our public rights. You who thought yourself up to that moment as simply being a number suddenly spring to life. You have that intoxicating feeling that you can make your own history, that you really count. And that you really count is the word, I think. So when Peggy Terry or Mary Lou Wolfe or Nancy Jefferson or Tiny Moten, these are different people in the book, do something, act, hey, I count. It's kind of, remember Flannery O'Connor's remarkable short story, she had many, The River. The River is the one of a Tennessee Williams-type couple who are drunk and decadent, sort of. They have a little boy, and the little boy is neglected, and he's cared for by this mountaineer woman who came out of the hills, the babysitter, who believes in the sanctified church and wild evangelical. Pentecostal stuff. And she takes the little boy to a baptizing. And his preacher is wild. And he dinks the kid in the water. And he says, "You count now." And the kid hears that word, "I count." And of course, it's tragic. The kid walks into the river later. But to count is what it's all about. And most people, they don't count. When you believe you count, and others do, then you obviously do something. The act itself becomes something that sets the juices flowing. Yes, sir.
Bring you back to reality.
Yes, to reality.
You mentioned briefly that things are happening now that may have not happened before. Could you elaborate on that in relation to generations or the recent past, some of that as you see it? And can you mention any areas that you feel particularly you've seen some signs of development?
Well, I think the anti-nuclear protests, even some have failed, are very significant indeed. Who ever questioned big business before, outside of crazy, nutty, loony radicals in the past? I use these adjectives advisedly. There was always a minority during the New Deal days and before Roosevelt came in. Who were the ones who marched for things as radical as Social Security and old age compensation, you know, and workman's compensation? But, you see, you have people challenging company. You got the tremendous Exxon ads, and they're overwhelming. And so they're lost in Maine. Overwhelming lobby. Yet you've got people who never participated. Sam Lovejoy in this book. He's the end of the book, before the epilogue. Sam is... He's just the eternal optimist. He's fantastic. He's the guy who tore down the tower in New Hampshire, and he made a case out of it. And he won the case, and he won the affection, admiration of the townspeople, including the wife of the chief of police and the National Guardsmen. So Sam is an example of someone who did his homework, who has a sense of humor, tremendously important, and who says something can be. At the same time, I'm not going to be a Pollyanna either. The battle is joined, and it's pretty rough, you know. Meantime, you got talk loony stuff about the MX missile. You know, it's absolutely Rube Goldberg. You know, it's crazy. Yeah?
How come white working people are voting for Reagan? What suppose there were a leftist candidate for president, or could be, what would he have to do to talk them out of that?
Well, I think there's a great deal of bewilderment. You know, day after day, you get it on the air. What are the issues that people get? A guy comes home, he's tired. I know a lot of guys, not a lot of guys, voting for Reagan. A nice guy. I've had it, studs. And he's had some personal difficulties with this guy who's Hispanic. And he suddenly blames on everything else. And he thinks of welfare. And I says, you're crazy. You know, I say to him. But he says, I want to change. And so the media's handling of the whole thing has been ridiculous to begin with. You know that. And so it's a battle. It's a tough battle.
My question.
I can't answer.
How come they're interested in Reagan? What do they see? What's good about him?
They don't say anything good about Reagan. They never said Reagan is good. None of them says Reagan's good.
Really?
They're just not going to vote for Carter. It's a negative. I haven't heard one of these guys who says Reagan is good. That's the whole point of it, you see. You hear Reagan good in the Reagan slogans, but you don't hear... Oh, you hear the guys who are hired, the actors with hard hats, so-called. They're actors hired to do it. Or some guy does it, gets a couple of bucks to do it. None of them says Reagan's good. That's the irony of the whole thing, you see.
Does your heart really warm up when you think of the American labor movement today?
No. Well, you see, there again, what are you going to say? You mean, does it warm up to the idea of George Meany or Lane Kirkland? Jesus Christ. You know, that's the whole point. At the same time, there is Eddie Sadlowski. He lost. He's not sorry he ran. There's Bill Wimpersinger in his own way and Jerry Wirth. It's a rough battle. Do my heart warm to the guys who run the labor movement? Oh, boy.
What do you say to people who indicate they may not vote because they feel none of the candidates are credible?
That in a way is voting, isn't it? I don't blame them. I'll say I'm for Barry Commoner. A lot of them never heard of Barry Commoner. You see, there's no money. There's a catch-22 here, you see. There's no money. Who the hell is the League of Women Voters anyway to decide 15%? Who chose them anyway as arbiters? Why couldn't it have been a whole slew of consumer groups? Who decided League of Women's Voters anyway? No one ever questioned. No one asked this impertinent question. And who the hell are they to decide 15%? Who'd they use? Newton Minow as a judge? Newton Minow, he's about as bush league as you can get, you know. He got a phrase called the wasteland, you know. A phrase that came to his mind during the Stevenson time. They got a couple others. Who made this? So what do you do? People who don't vote, I'm not blaming them. I say it's too bad. I'd like to see them vote for somebody, but... Anyway, let's get on to the book and stuff. You know how it works.
Tell us a little more about how what engendered the American dreams, of what engendered the book, and how you got from working through that book on power, which
well,
you said
it
didn't
just,
write.
I think it just came about. I didn't know what to do. I had finished, I'd given up the power book, and yet I knew there was something in it that would fit in some other book, and it does here in a tangential way. I had done my memoir, I call it Talking to Myself, in between this. I want to do my own writing, you see. And I do here, in the beginning and end, in all the books, but I still wanted to prove I can write. And so I did Talking to Myself, which is a memoir, free association of the times, but also of me, sort of a spectator, reluctantly becoming a participant, you know. And so this book, I think at a certain, I didn't know what I was thinking. I love the hymn, Amazing Grace, and there's a line in it, you know. Amazing, the verse, Amazing Grace, how sweet thy sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And so in a way, it's kind of revelation, too, like this guy, C.P. Ellis. And so I thought of that, and American Dream was a title and also a concept that is cliché. But what does it mean today? And we are at the certain moment, the great many people questioning, where the hell are we going? You know, who have never questioned before. And so it just came about in that way. Again, I can't say specifically, I never could, how come I did it or why I did it. It's an accretion of different thoughts and associations, you know.
Tell me something about how the Federal Writers Project got you involved.
Oh, the Federal Writers Project played a big part in my life. You know, I was an actor before that. Now, at first, I went to law school, right? I dreamed of Clarence Darrow, and I woke up to Julius Hoffman. And then I thought of contracts and real property, and it was not for me. It was me. So then came a statistical project, WPA, and then I was a gangster in soap operas. You know, I'm the guy who always say, get in there, you guys, you know. I'm the one. So once there was this one director, looked just like Einstein, and that was the only similarity. And this director said, Lewis, he called me Lewis then, give me Humphrey Bogart. So I said, get in there, you guys. And he says, no, not now, as he was 10 years ago. So I say, get in here, you guys. Great. Now, give me Jimmy Cagney. So I say, get in here, you guys. Okay, great. And now, give me Edward G. Robinson. No, give me Eddie Robinson. See, all these guys knew. They never say John Barrymore, Jack Barrymore. He says, give me Eddie. I says, Edward G. Robinson. So I said, get in there, you guys. Great. And so that's how I was. I had to learn to type, but also wrote. And one thing led to another. It was writing. That was marvelous. There was one moment, you know, Colonel McCormick of the Tribune hated the New Deal, of course, and he especially hated the arts projects, including writers and theater projects, and the cartoons on the Tribune were violent. This is part of the humorous anecdote. And so the Tribune cartoons were always the crazy loony prof with a hammer and sickle, and this is the writers' project or the theater project, and be on every day in color. He was the first guy to use color on the front page. And so we're assigned, summarized, to do works of great artists with the Chicago Art Institute, the lives of, and you work with the curator. That I did one something on Daumier, something on Aikens, on Albert Pinkham Ryder, and on Van Gogh. Someone else did something on Picasso or Rembrandt. And we worked, it was done over WGN, Colonel McCormick's station. He owned the station. And at the end it would say, under the auspices, that have the writer's name, under the auspices of the Federal Writers Something Administration, WP Work Projects Administration, Harry Hopkins, director. And he loathed. Colonel McCormick called up every week. He says, that's a very good show. Colonel says, that's a marvel. I'm so proud of that program. And here he is, the very thing he's didn't even know who was sponsoring it. Anyway, so I was working on that. And then that's how I became a writer. That's simple. I wasn't ready. Then I didn't. Then I was a disc jockey for years, and then I was on a TV show called Studs Place. I might tell you a word about that show. That was knocked off McCarthy days, but also would have been knocked off anyway. There were three shows in Chicago back in 1950, 51, 52. TV was new, and TV was not the sales medium it is today. So it was in the hands of the people making it, the artists, the writers, actors, directors. And there were three shows in Chicago, Garraway at Large, Kukran Alley, and Studs Place, and they were called Chicago-style TV, improvised. Well, on this show, I never, ever, none of us ever played down to the audience. And so I had an audience that was quite remarkable, by the way. It would have embossed stationery from a dowager, signed with an X by a scrub woman, a prof, a truck driver, because I think, I'm trying to figure what it was. I think we never played down to the audience. So once, it was an anti-cigarette show, long before the anti-cigarette campaign. We'd read about a man named Alton Oxner of the University of, somewhere in Tulane. And so we just do an anti, and so I loved cigars and smoke, so we're cutting it out, and somebody's blowing a cigar my way, and I'm saying, oh, I'm Ulysses, tie me to the mast, passing the Isle of Circe. And so the guy said, that's crazy, you're not going to do that. I said, well, they won't know what you're talking about. I said, I'm going to do it. They don't know, they're going to look it up. That's okay. One day they will. I'll be damned if I'm going to play. So I kept it in. And that's what I mean about not underestimating. I suppose the old phrase is don't underestimate the intelligence of a people. Don't overestimate the awareness of issues. Anyway, so that's more or less. And then the writing was, again, accidental.
That labor union guy, the organizer.
Eddie Sadlowski. Oh, this is interesting. I want to read you. You gave me an idea, Fred. This connects also with Aikenfield. Aikenfield was a marvelous. I wish you could read that. That's the. I don't mean to be modest. That's the best of the series by Ronald Blythe. It's here, I know. Yes. It's about a small English town. Ronald Blythe is a magnificent writer. He just did a great book on age, by the way, A View in Winter. Magnificent book. And Ronald Blythe has a young British guy, and we'll come to Ed Sadlowski here. Interesting, this parallel. Thank you. I carry this around with me. This young guy from Aikenfield, David Collier, a town boy, meaning a working class boy, this is from Aikenfield, can drift into an art gallery if it's only to get warm and see a picture, and then begin to feel and think about art. Or you might go to a concert just to see what it was like, or hang around a big public library. And the minute he does these things, he begins to be a different person, even if he doesn't realize it. I was over 20. Here's the point. I was over 20 before I realized that classical music was just music. And therefore, all one had to do was listen to it. And here's the part. I listened. At first, I believed I had no right to listen to it. Now, think about that. You have people, Mozart, Beethoven. Well, it's beyond me, they'd say. It isn't for me. It's for the dowagers who go first night at the opera, who know much about Mozart or Beethoven as a two-year-old child, you know. You know, I listened at first. I had no right to listen. I felt affected. But when I began to enjoy it, I stopped worrying. Everything begins with doubt and insecurity, as though I'm using a language I haven't the right to use. And then he goes on. Now, here's Ed Sadlowski, who had never read Aikenfield, and didn't know about this guy. And here's what Ed says. It's in the city, right here. Here's Ed Sadlowski. I see guys getting tired of being put down as economic apes, as Archie Bunkers. Even though they didn't have formal education, I've heard some of the greatest stuff come from them. I know a lot of these guys hang iron in South Chicago. They aren't racists. I rarely see a guy walk around with an American flag on a hard hat. Hollywood depicts them that way. You don't become an American by virtue of wearing a damn decal on a hard hat. But give a guy, here's the part I wanted. Give a guy a chance to see a countryside, and he'll appreciate it. Give him the opportunity to have time to read a book, and he'll read. Give him an opportunity to have time to listen to music, and he'll listen. Human nature is more than punching a clock and going home. You ever watch a guy grow when he's exposed to a new experience? He becomes addicted. He wants more. He starts reading the book. He starts doing this, doing that. Before you know it, boom, like a flower opening up. And he goes on. And he says, you won't find music halls. Down in our mill town, you don't find, to this day, flower beds or tree-lined streets. You won't find music halls unless the guy also brings a guitar or a harmonica. The boss had his way, you never find libraries and books. They're dangerous. Shouldn't there be parks and theaters and libraries in my community? Well, Eddie is saying the same thing this guy's saying. So again, we talk. Again, they'll say, you're romanticizing the working man. Well, I'm not. I know a lot of guys are stinkers. There's a lot of other guys are stinkers, too. It's just a question, there's something going on. I suppose the thing I'd like to wind this up, perhaps, is to treat things and accept things as they are is easy and dull and shallow journalism. To see what they might be is what's so exciting, indeed what they can be. So Miles Horton, who is not in the book, see, says he has his Highlander folk school where Rosa Parks went to school. And maybe if there were no Highlander, Rosa Parks might not have sat down on that bus, but someone would have. Well, their Klansmen go there too, as well as black organizers at this Highlander school. And Miles says, I look at a guy with two eyes. With one eye, I see him as he is, with the other, as he might possibly be. And John Howard Griffin, this was on John Howard's deathbed, I did the interview, I might as well tell you. John Howard Griffin, the theologian, died, did Black Like Me, brilliant. And I was calling John, and his wife said, he'd like to see you very much. And she said, you know, John is dying. He hung on for years. He says, John would love to see you, wants to very bad. So I did, at John's bedside. And John is saying, accepting people as they are ain't going to do it. No. And he speaks of those parts. So it's the what can be is what it's all about, really. So, thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.